said. And tonight, we are privileged to hear him talk to us on the subject of the modern family and its origins. Professor Stone.
Well, I should warn you that my interests may be broad-ranged. I'm not very good at high-tech. The last time I wore one of these things, I tore it out of the ground and broke the fuses in the building. I trust this won't happen tonight. Let me begin by a rather boring but necessary exercise in definition of terms. By the modern family, I do not mean the family type which has emerged in the last few years, the late 1970s and 1980s, which I think may be called the postmodern, and whose predominant features will be analyzed and explained at the conclusion of this lecture. The essential characteristic of the modern family, which reached its apogee, in my opinion, between about 1920 and 1970, are as follows. It is nuclear in both living arrangements and psychological orientation, meaning that not only do most households consist of no more than parents and children, but the prime bonding is between these groups and not with grandparents, uncles, cousins, or other relatives and kin. The couple is formed as a result of the free choice of a spouse by both partners without very much economic or moral pressures being exerted by parents and is subsequently bonded by affection, friendship, and companionship. Great stress is laid on the sexual bond and both partners are expected to be imaginative and active in mutual sexual play and innovation. Sexual fidelity is expected in the wife, but to a lesser extent in the husband. Husbands and wives are partners in a joint economic enterprise. The wife normally concerned, this is up to 1970, mind you, let's get this wrong, primarily with domestic management and child rearing, and the husband with breadwinning outside the home. The family is strongly child-oriented, meaning that great sacrifices of time and money are made for the optimal nurturance and education of the children, and intense love is directed towards them. Now, obviously, what I've been describing to you is an ideal type, not a description of reality. We don't live this way, obviously. But since nature imitates art, the ideal tends to create its own reality. And this type of family, let me warn you, is very rare in world history. It emerged at a highly specific moment in time, in a highly specific class, in a specific place, and its origins in evolution can only be discovered by close historical analysis. Now, this talk of mine consists of three parts, which I should warn you move downwards in a progressively declining order of certainty and reliability. The first part is an outline of the facts of change in behavior and human relationships which took place in particular circles in 18th century England. And in this area, I at least am quite sure of my facts. The second part probes behind these facts to uncover the underlying motives for the changes I have observed. Now, in my opinion, though not, of course, others, this is fairly secure, but of course much less so than the first. And the third part plunges into a treacherous bog of explanatory speculation and hypotheses. If a historian is to do duty by his profession, he must, I think, try to make sense of the past. And this means attempting to answer the why questions as well as the what and the how. Now, before I begin, let me make three points absolutely clear to you. First, I'm not talking about the population as a whole, but only the upper bourgeoisie and professional classes, the landed squirearchy, and increasing numbers of the nobility. The principle of the diffusion of cultural norms, in this case sweeping upwards and downwards in the social system from two middling groups very slowly over a period of at least 150 years, is central to my analysis of what actually happened. Secondly, I am not describing the beginning of an inevitable march of progress leading directly to the modern family, although I am, I believe, identifying the beginnings of a wholly new cultural configuration which had never occurred before, which was to prepare the way for the current situation we're in today. Some of the changes which I'm about to describe as taking place in the 18th century were in fact actually reversed in the 19th century during the Victorian period and then picked up again with redoubled force in the 20th century. And thank God I do not have to explain the problem of the Victorians tonight. Thirdly, I am trying to define states of mind and normative value systems, not codes of behavior that were universally practiced. Indeed, if you want to be pedantic about it, there are obviously as many types of emotional relationships within the family as there are families. So when I say that people, so far as I can see, were more warm and affectionate towards each other in the 18th century than the 17th, I do not mean to say that love and affection did not exist before the 18th century. Of course they did. It would be idiotic to say anything else. What I do mean, however, is that in the 18th century, these values for the first time became highly prized and that it received the support of theologians and moralists and even lawyers in a way which had never happened before, and that, as a result, far more individuals, indeed in certain circles a majority, began to behave in a new way. Now, the fact that I am unable to produce a graph to demonstrate that the love quotient rose from, say, 24.4% to 72.3% from the 16th to the 18th centuries doesn't bother me, and I hope it doesn't bother you. My evidence is literary and not quantitative, and my question is merely this. When, how, and why does a new type of behavior become generally admired and move from being regarded as a deplorable eccentricity to being a norm to which most people aspire to conform? So now, after these preliminaries, let's begin with the first section, which is the hard facts, the facts about observed changes which occurred in the 18th century. In the first place, there were major changes in the standard theory about the nature of the newborn child. In 17th century Calvinist theory, as you are no doubt aware, the child was born with original sin, and his best chance of salvation was, quite literally, to beat the hell out of it. That is to say, to crush its stubborn will by brute force, mainly by whipping it. Now, in the late 17th century, this was replaced as the standard doctrine by the theory that the child is born as a tabula rasa, a sheet of blank paper upon which experience will write either evil or good. Furthermore, parents were advised that kindness was more effective than brutality in inculcating virtue, and mutual respect was better than deference. At the same time, the unique individuality of the child was increasingly recognized, replacing what I would call the substitution theory, which was previously current, according to which dead children were easily replaced by new ones. Now, you may say, how do I know this? And my best evidence is in the changing in the naming of children. During the Middle Ages in the 16th century, it was common practice to give two or more living children the same first name. The reason being that if one died, there would always be another to carry on the name. Now, in the 17th century, this practice disappeared. On the other hand, it still remained common to baptize an infant with the name of an elder brother who had recently died, or an elder sister who had recently died. John Benjamin Wesley is an excellent example, since both his names, both John and Benjamin, are those of dead siblings. By the end of the 18th century, however, almost every child now had his own unique name, and such duplication, even for dead children, was extremely rare. Now, I regard, though not everybody agrees with me, this change in child naming patterns as convincing evidence of a shift from a substitution theory of children to a recognition of the uniqueness of each individual upon earth. Well, you may think this is pretty fancy stuff, and let's try and provide some more hard data for you. Now, I think further evidence of the change is provided by changes in the actual treatment of infants and young children. In the 18th century, there took place two radical changes in the way small infants were treated. First, the abandonment of swaddling, and secondly, the adoption of maternal breastfeeding. Now, swaddling, as you know, is a practice of wrapping the child from head to foot, tightly bound, unable to move legs, hands, arms, even head. The body is absolutely mobile. You tie the thing up round and round and round with bandages so it can't move from the head to the shoulder. It's absolutely immobile. That's it. Now, in the 18th century, medical and philosophical opinion turned against swaddling. Although this has been standard practice in Western Europe, certainly since the classical period, and probably for thousands and tens of thousands of years before that. By 1785, it was said that in England, quote, the barbarous custom of swaddling children like mummies is now almost entirely laid aside. And indeed, there's plenty of evidence to prove that's actually factually correct. Now, what's interesting about this is England was far ahead of continental Europe in this matter, far ahead of France, for example. What we can see is the change spreading slowly across Europe over a period of 250 years, only reaching Russia in the 20th century. It's about as clear an example of the slow geographical spread of a cultural pattern that I know of. I should add, by the way, that the reasons for this are still rather obscure. And the fact that the reasons used by the 18th century are probably false. Recent research has been conducted on the Hopi Indian children. Now, the Hopi Indian children, some of them are educated and brought up in the modern way, not swaddled, and others in the traditional Hopi way, swaddled. And so the psychologists have gone in at the age of 6 or 7 and tested these children, and they cannot find any significant difference between the two. In terms of learning ability, physical characteristics, etc., they appear to be identical. So there's no real hard evidence that it matters one way or another whether you swaddle the child or whether you don't. However, this is not the argument used by the 18th century. And it seems to me the basic cause of the shift seems to be less the medical arguments, which were indeed used. They say it was very bad for children, you shouldn't do this, but rather the emergence of a new ideal of freedom, the desire to give the infants autonomy, to allow them to kick and move about freely. But it's important to note that change also made possible close body contact between infant and mother. That is to say, it facilitated hugging and fondling, and this greatly increased the emotional bonding between parents and children. As we've known but from tests on primates, on chimpanzees and orangutans and things, this is a very, very central link between mother and child in primates and presumably, therefore, in human beings. Now, breastfeeding by mothers, which is the second change, had been advocated by the medical profession since classical antiquity, since Galen. But in fact, the advice had been totally ignored by all upper-class women who could afford to hire a wet nurse. Now, this too changed quite quickly in the late 18th century, exactly the same time span, so that by 1784 it was said that, quote, even women of quality now nurse their children. And indeed, it is easy to prove they did. Why did they do it? After 2,000 years of ignoring medical advice, why did they suddenly change? The first argument, I think, was a growing concern for children amongst mothers, which I'll come to in a minute, who now wanted to feed their own children, despite the possible damage to the shape of their breasts and the certain interference with their sleep and their social life. They had recognized that it was bad for the children to put them out to wet nurse. They probably died of it. And if they didn't, they'd pick up all sorts of diseases, and they would be better off if they were nursed by their own mothers. Secondly, changes occurred in the attitude of the fathers. Doubts were now arising about the truth of the main reason why, before the 18th century, most women who could afford it hired a wet nurse. This was the medical theory that sexual excitement spoils the milk, and that nursing mothers, therefore, should not sleep with their husbands. Now, since breastfeeding up till the 18th century and early 19th century lasted a year or more, indeed normally up to 2 years, husbands who could afford it naturally insisted that the children should be sent out to wet nurse in order not to be deprived for such long period of time of the sexual services of their wives. Doesn't seem at all unnatural to me, anyway. So both medical profession and the laity were now beginning to question this theory simply because they observed that children of the poor, who did not observe this taboo, see that children of the poor seem to flourish quite well, so they said, well, maybe the medical theory is wrong. And consequently, the objection of husbands to maternal breastfeeding was considerably reduced. Now, we can produce, I think, other evidence of the same trend towards a greater emotional concern for the child and greater familial intimacy, even in families with plenty of servants, from the correspondence and diaries of devoted mothers and also fathers, some of whom spent a lot of time in the 18th century playing with their children. This greater affection dissolved the old formalities which have hitherto governed the relations of parents and children. I'm sure you will find it hard to believe what I'm going to say to you, but I think it's a demonstrable fact that in the early 17th century, I hope we're having problems here. There we are. In the early 17th century, Strict rituals of deference of the child who is the parents were in fact regularly practiced. That is to say, the child did actually kneel daily to ask his parents' blessing. He did always keep his hat off in his parents' presence. He did stand or even kneel in his parents' presence even when adult, until he was told to sit down. He didn't speak until he was spoken to. He really didn't. You find it hard to believe, he honestly didn't. He got beaten up if he did. Now, in the late 17th century, this disappeared. The mode of address of children to parents changed correspondingly. In the 16th and early 17th centuries, you addressed your parents as sir and madam. In the 18th century, you addressed them as papa and mama. As Mrs. Howard explained in 1800, quote, "When children like ours live much with parents, there is no longer that great distance observed which engendered fear and was the bane of confidential intercourse. Moreover, the physical and psychological pressures to discipline the child and break its will were now relaxed. In the late 18th century, Henry Lord Holland gave very clear instructions for the education of his son, the future Charles James Fox. Quote, "The child's spirit shall not be broken. The world will do that soon enough." Now, of course, the inevitable result, as you could probably imagine, was the emergence in England in the middle of the 18th century, for the first time in history, so far as I'm aware, of the spoiled child problem. To a degree and an extent unparalleled before, and unparalleled again until the late 20th century in America and Northwest Europe. I don't know about Canada, so I don't propose to speak about it. Children were brought into adult dinner parties in the late 18th century to be shown off and ruined adult conversation by their cries and chatter, as Boswell complained bitterly. They were often rude and impertinent to parents and guests. And parents had to treat them with extraordinary deference. In 1762, Henry Lord Holland wrote a letter to his son at Eton, which I think could hardly be matched at any other period in history, except our own. Quote, "I much wanted to see your hair cut to a reasonable length and gentlemanlike shortness. You and some Eton boys wear it as no other people in the world do. It is effeminate, it is ugly, and it must be inconvenient. You gave me hopes that if I desired it, you would cut it. I will, dear Steve, be much obliged if you would." Now, of course, a normal parent throughout the whole of history said, "Go and get your goddamn haircut." And this is a totally unique, seems to me, a very, very extraordinary thing to say and write to a child. The conclusion one can draw from these diverse scraps of evidence, I think, is that in some high professional landed circles in England by the late 18th century, there had developed an astonishingly permissive style of child rearing. Another symptom of the same trend towards greater laxity in discipline was the decline of flogging in schools. In the 16th and 17th centuries, severe whipping with birch bundles on the bare buttocks had been the normal daily punishment for the most minor of academic lapses. You got a slight piece of Latin grammar wrong and you were in trouble. In about 1670, however, there began a concerted attack on this practice, strongly reinforced by John Locke in a best-selling handbook about child rearing published in 1693. The arguments used were that it pandered to the sadistic taste of the schoolmaster and indeed created later masochistic sexual taste in the boys. Now, I should point out the whole theory of sadomasochism was fully worked out by intellectual theorists in the late 17th century England. Secondly, they argued that it anyway didn't work. It made boys associate learning with physical pain and so hate it. And thirdly, it was wrong to treat gentlemen like slaves. The result was, in fact, a considerable diminution of the practice. Hands were increasingly substituted for buttocks. The amount of punishment in the greatest public schools was severely reduced, now being limited to discipline for serious moral offences, as opposed to daily minor academic ones. Mind you, I mean, don't get too excited about this. It didn't make the lives of the boys much better, because they were increasingly abandoned by their teachers to the mercy of the older boys, who were free to torture them at will, which, of course, being boys, they did. As the private schools and academies, however, it is very interesting, I think, to note that by about the 1780s, you find that they were specifically advertising in the newspapers that they never whipped their children, their pupils. This was now clearly a selling point amongst prospective parents who wished to send their children to schools which did not flog pupils. They no longer wanted their children to be flogged for trivial offences. However, in my view, the most convincing piece of evidence for a change in parent-child relations is the new freedom of choice of children to select their own spouse. Between about 1660 and 1780, there took place a critical shift in the allocation of power over the choice of a spouse. In the Middle Ages, in the 16th century, the early 17th century, in all classes with any piece of property, and that goes quite low throughout the social system, it doesn't include the very poor with no property, but any parent with property, the prospective spouse was chosen by the parents. Although the children were now allowed a right of veto by the 17th century, based on a brief encounter. What would happen? Well, the parents would get together and fix up with the lawyers and fix up the marriage, the financial arrangements of the marriage. They would then introduce the boy to the girl, leave him alone for a couple of hours, and come in and say, well, you're going to take her or not. I mean, make up your mind. You can't mess around. The document is signed. The lawyer's waiting. We can't fiddle around with it. And you had to say yes or no very rapidly, and that was it. You were stuck for life if you made the wrong choice. Too bad. Because divorce did not exist in those days. And I'm not exaggerating, that this is really what happened. And indeed, for a girl, it was a particularly traumatic experience, because if she said no more than once to her father, he might get fed up and simply abandon any further attempts to marry her off at all. Now, by the late 18th century, we jump on 100 years, we find the norm had shifted to the choice of a spouse by the children themselves, following a period of courtship which lasted several months. Normally, 3 to 6 months was a normal period of courtship in the late 18th century. The parents now reserved the right of veto, but only in the cases of social incompatibility or they personally hated the prospective father-in-law or something of that sort. By 1780, the change was largely complete within the groups under discussion, as can easily be demonstrated by masses of examples. Now, I think that the moment when parents first became willing, indeed felt themselves morally obliged, to leave young people free to select their own mates, marks a major watershed in the history of mankind. The shift is the acid test to the rise of individualism as a recognized ideal. Now, if the choice now passed to the individuals themselves, the problem of motive remained unsolved throughout the century. Indeed, remained the central theme of the novel, from Defoe to Jane Austen and beyond. There was a prolonged conflict between, on the one hand, the old motive of what was called interest, meaning money, property, and political influence, the traditional basis of family strategy, and on the other, the new motive of well-tried and settled affection. And slowly the balance tipped from the one to the other. It looks as if the bourgeoisie were the first to take the plunge, though the evidence here is very, very shaky. It's very hard to determine which social class first began to practice this new attitude towards leaving children free to marry their own spouses. It appears to me, however, that the first people I can document, anyway, who were actually saying this very, very severely were men like Daniel Defoe, who were catering for a bourgeois, middle-class London market. Now, by the early 18th century, the ideal was spreading fast amongst the squirearchy, and the mid-18th century affecting the high aristocracy, being spread in particular throughout these landed classes by Addison and Steele in The Spectator and The Tatler, the two most important periodicals of the day, the widely read ones. However, let's be quite clear about two things. We're not yet in the 20th century. This is an 18th century situation. The two motives which at least are commonly supposed to lead to marriage today, namely strong sexual attraction and romantic love, were both of them totally rejected by the 18th century. No one would give them any credence at all. They were regarded as ephemeral passions which formed no true basis for a lasting relationship. In that sense, the 18th century was still a long way from the 20th. Now, another piece of evidence is the appearance of new emotional relationships between the spouses themselves. The 18th century sees the growth in the groups under discussion of what I call the companionate marriage, in which the husband and wife were increasingly thrown together without external social supports and bonded to each other by ties of friendship. And this word friend comes back in the correspondence of the 18th century in a sort of extraordinary way. Constantly this word friend is repeated again and again, meaning what we today mean by the word friend. The greater isolation of the nuclear pair from friends and from relatives and kin is one of the most obvious features of 18th century family life. In politics, cousinhood counted for less, with less interference by relatives in domestic quarrels and decision-making. And one sort of concrete piece of evidence of how things were changing was the change in the nature of the honeymoon. Before, it had been a huge, prolonged collective party, with relatives and friends lasting up to a week or more, during which the couple were almost never alone, not even in bed. Necessarily, anyway. It then changed to its modern meaning as a period of withdrawal and isolation for mutual sexual and emotional exploration. Now, I have to confess, if I'm going to be honest with you, there is one striking exception to this model of increasing isolation of the couple and the increasing bonding of the couple, which I can't explain, doesn't fit, and I don't know what to do about it, but I better tell you it. In every other respect, you have increased participation of husband and wife in leisure activities, in balls, at races, at parties, the card table, and so on. They're going around together in a way which astonished the French visitors to London. The exception, which I cannot explain, is that extraordinary English upper-class habit of segregating the sexes immediately after dinner. You are in the middle of the dinner, towards the end of dinner, the women are sort of suddenly whipped away and they vanish. And the men settle down to port for an hour or two and then rejoin the ladies later. You know that some of you may have experienced this bizarre practice. It's never ceased to astonish foreigners who are absolutely stunned by it. It's also a mystery to the historians. We really don't understand it. We don't know when it began, we don't know why it began, and we really don't know why it persisted into the 20th century. Now, historians are not prophets, but I would prepare to bet a great deal of money that the women's liberation movement would have put an end to this within the next 10 years. Maybe it has already, I don't know. The women haven't been removed from my presence at the party for about 5 years now, so maybe it's on the way out. Other evidence of greater affection between spouses is found in the language of family correspondence, which becomes more warm, more chatty, more affectionate, and so on. And there's evidence of greater equality in decision-making about matters of where to live, where to send the children to school, and so on. I think this change was enormously stimulated by the striking improvement in the quality of female education in the 18th century, which I think has been grossly ignored hitherto. By the end of the century, the wife was now more nearly the intellectual equal of her husband in almost every respect, except in two areas, theology and classics, where it remained exclusively masculine monopolies. But who cares about them anyway? It doesn't seem to me they matter very much. Now, it's important not to get too enthusiastic about all these changes. The results, as you might suppose, if you're slightly cynical, were ambiguous. I think there are more obviously happy marriages, but it also looks as if there may have been more quarrels, more separations, and more adulterous love affairs. I don't think that's very surprising. It's obvious the expectation of a higher threshold of marital happiness and sexual satisfaction for both spouses will result in greater prospects of disappointment. The greater sharing of decision-making will increase the chances of quarreling. The greater child orientation will split the mother's loyalty between her husband and her children. Accordingly, as the companionate marriage became the norm in the 18th century, it was accompanied by evidence of substantial and possibly growing, I'm not sure about that, but possibly growing marital breakdowns and separations. And as we all know, a similar developments are producing similar results in our own day. Now, well, that's the first section of this talk, setting out the facts, which I think are proven really beyond dispute for England, and also we now know for the American upper and middle classes, just a little later, from about 1780 to 1820, the change seems to have taken place right up and down the eastern seaboard of America, from Massachusetts to Virginia. We've had a series of books in the last 3 or 4 years which have quite independently done, bearing no relation to the work I've done myself, independently of one another, coming up with exactly the same conclusions, exactly the same data, from reading the correspondence all the way from Boston down to Charleston. Now, if those are the facts, let's now probe behind the facts and ask what lay behind them. Behind them, I think there was a change of values and norms, which I have described as the rise of, I'm afraid it's a sort of jargonistic social science phrase, affective individualism. Now, by individualism, I mean two things. I mean an awareness of the self as unique, and second, a recognition of the right of that unique self to pursue selfish goals. Now, individualism is a fairly rare phenomenon in human history. It has triumphed in the West at a particular moment and for a very complicated set of reasons. You don't have to do more than read the newspapers to realize that in the vast bulk of the world, in Latin America, the whole of Africa, the whole of the communist world, and in the whole of East Asia, such ideals are not respected. So we are a minority, a tiny minority, in the history of the world. Well, let us look, first of all, for evidence of individualism in society as a whole. I think we can see this a number of ways. In the 16th century, we find for the first time intimately revealing new forms of written self-expression. The diary, the autobiography, the love letter. Diaries before 1700 were indeed mostly religious in content and inspiration, and the Puritans bulk disproportionately large amongst their authors. They were clearly the product of the inner-directed personality, what David Reisman has called the separation of the behaving and the recording self. The autobiography was somewhat similar. By 1620, autobiographies were being, for the first time, written in considerable quantities, mainly like diaries, to record religious experiences. After 1660, however, they had become rapidly more secular in content. And indeed, the 1660s sees the first autobiography of a woman, which is primarily concerned with her love life, and the first biography, of course, forced diary of a man, Pepys, which is primarily but considerably concerned with his sex life. The third form, the love letter, also makes an important jump of numbers in the post-1660 period. So I think we may conclude that evident signs of a rise of individualism, stimulated by literacy, inspired by Calvinism, and then inherited from Calvinism by the more secular society which evolved after 1660. Now, the concept of the autonomy of the individual to make his or her own decisions has a rather different roots. The early 16th century, let me remind you, has seen an actual reversal of this trend. The early 16th century had been a period when there was significant intensification of the pressures made to make the individual conform to the values deemed appropriate by the local elite. The Reformation and Counter-Reformation churches had whipped, tortured, and burned to make men conform to their particular interpretation of the meaning of the Eucharist. The Renaissance state whipped, tortured, and hanged to suppress dissidents and to enforce obedience to the reigning monarch and his orders. Treason was extended to the spoken word, and thought control became ever more intensive. After 1660, however, there began a slow swing of opinion against these excesses. I think there were four main reasons for this new affirmation of the rights of the individual to think his own thoughts. The first was religious sectarianism, the fragmentation of the unity of Christianity, which contained with it the ultimate right of the appeal to the individual conscience as a justification for the rejection of an order by what was called an ungodly magistrate, that is to say, a secular leader, maybe a king, who orders you to do something which is deemed to be against the word of God. Moreover, as a measure of practical survival for small and unpopular minorities, like conformist, non-conformist sects, they were obliged to advocate religious toleration only to survive. The second reason was, I think, the antithesis of the first, namely a growing revulsion against all types of religious enthusiasm. The hostility to enthusiasm, as it was called in the late 17th and 18th centuries, is quite astonishing. So latitude and indifference to all things religious, a concept that enthusiasm about religion endangered society, endangered the state, and was an unchristian principle. By 1700, after 170 years of religious conflict, toleration seemed to be the only way to obtain social stability and political peace, and the only moral way to behave. Furthermore, there was in the Anglo-Saxon world a common law tradition of particular liberties, expressed in the veneration of Magna Carta and a strong insistence on the legal protection of the individual, which found expression in the Petition of Right of 1628, runs on to the English Bill of Rights of 1689, and so on to the American Bill of Rights. And lastly, there was the growth of secular ideas of natural law, the notion that each man or woman has a property right in him or herself. Each man or woman owns him or herself, as expressed most forcibly by John Locke. Now, at the root of most of these significant changes from the late 17th and 18th century, there lies, it seems to me, a progressive secularization of culture. A passive submission to the inscrutable will of God was giving way to a growing confidence in man's capacity to master his environment and turn it to his use and benefit. And once there was hope of escaping from unpredictable catastrophe, it became possible and reasonable to assert one's right to determine one's own future. Now, why this sense of control over the environment occurred is a very mysterious question. It's perfectly clear that the claims of the scientists widely outran their capacity. From Bacon onwards, scientists were claiming to control the universe. They could not. They couldn't change anything. They were unable to make any individual human being live a day longer than it did before until the 19th century. And this was true of almost anything. They could understand through Newton how the cosmology worked. They couldn't do anything to improve human life. Nothing. At least virtually nothing. The first and only major medical breakthrough, for example, which gave families some proof that this might be true, that maybe we can control our own environment, was the success of inoculation, not vaccination, inoculation, in preventing smallpox, which was brought in the 1720s and became fairly uniform by the 1750s, which saved hundreds of thousands of children's lives, sight and beauty, in the 18th century. Other influences, of course, were at work to encourage the growth of what is called possessive individualism in economic affairs. Commercial, industrial, and agricultural expansion, driven forward by individual entrepreneurs using new technologies to increase production, were effective in changing attitudes to economic freedom. The world of Adam Smith was, after all, a world of individualists whose selfish and greedy actions resulted, so he claimed, to the benefit of society as a whole. The analogous intellectual innovation of the period was placed the selfish quest for pleasure in this world as the center of all human motivation. Instead of a search for God, it was a search for pleasure. This pursuit of happiness, which concluded both the spiritual and the physical pleasure of the individual, was more than just an 18th century elitist fad which somehow found its way into the American Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson knew exactly what he was doing when he used it. He was adopting a widespread and powerful notion of 18th century philosophy, which was essential to the rise of effective individualism, namely, quote, the desire to live happily as one of the essential bases of human life. Another novel movement which gathered strength throughout this period was a growing antipathy to cruelty. Now, let me insist as a historian that antipathy to cruelty is not a normal human reaction. This is historically a pretty rare phenomenon. It is not apparently natural to the human species. It is culturally induced. But the origin of the sentiment of dislike of cruelty may perhaps be traced back to some obscure zone in English Puritan sentiment. Since the first clear expression that I can find of it is found in the Liberties of Massachusetts Colony, written in 1648. Here, for the first time, so far as I'm aware, a state legislated to prohibit cruelty to domestic animals, as well as to such other helpless and inferior creatures as servants, apprentices, and women. Now, a few years before, the English state had quietly abandoned the official use of torture to extract information from political prisoners. Why? Why on earth should a state give up torturing its subjects if it wants to? Most states still do it today. It's obviously useful. Why give it up? There's only one possible reason why a state should abandon this practice, let us say, a moral one, a sense that is simply against a moral duty to other people. Now, this hostility to cruelty received new stimulus in the middle of the 18th century when a connection was made between the maltreatment of animals and the maltreatment of murder of human beings. It was the theme of Hogarth's influential set of prints, The Four Stages of Cruelty, published in 1751, and reinforced in the late 18th century by the new ideal of a man of sentiment, as he was called, epitomized in Henry Mackenzie's novel called The Man of Feeling, published in 1777. And if you will indulge me with one tiny piece of quantification, this book describes an outburst of weeping by one sex or another every 10.5 pages, which must be darn nearly a record. Well, my reading is concerned, it is a record. Well, okay, that's a sort of broad description of evidence of individualism to floating around in the society as a whole, affecting the whole political and social system. What about within the family itself? Well, obviously, individualism can't flourish within the family until you destroy patriarchy, i.e., the doctrine of the father and the husband is the absolute monarch of his kingdom. This work of destruction, as you know, was accomplished by the first of John Locke's two treatises of government, written in 1683 or 4, there or thereabouts. The first treatise, which nobody reads today, in fact launched a major onslaught on a recently published book called Patriarcha by Robert Filmer, which based its case for the divine right of kings and passive obedience to kings on the analogy of the authority of the husband and the father over the family as granted to Adam over Eve. Locke argued that the power of the father over his wife and children were merely a functional byproduct of the need to nourish and support them. And so far as children were concerned, it ended once the children were grown up and could look after themselves. It was just a limited and temporary authority and therefore was irrelevant to anything arguments about the nature of kingship. Now, what's interesting is that Locke's political theory was very quickly taken up by the feminists and used in the current debate over the relations of males and females. In 1701, a leading feminist, Mary Chudley, criticized men because, quote, passive obedience you've transferred to us. That antique doctrine you disown, 'tis now your scorn and fit for us alone. Let's say you've abandoned it when you're dealing with kings, but you still hang on to it when you want to hang on to your own authority within the family. Other evidence pointing in the same direction comes from the decline of family prayers and the growth of desire for physical privacy. The 16th and 17th centuries sees an intensification of the role of a husband and father as a religious head of the household, reinforced by a regular assembly of the household twice a day to hear him lead the family in prayer. In the late 17th and 18th centuries, this died out altogether. It came back in the Victorian period. It is now, to my experience, virtually gone altogether. Now, this rise, this fall, this rise again, and then now total collapse, obviously coincides with the rise and fall of religious zeal, but also with the rise and fall of domestic patriarchy. The most striking change in the lifestyle of the upper classes at this time was a greater stress laid on physical privacy. The upper class members of the family ceased to dine in public on the high table and withdrew to the private dining room. When they travelled, it was not in a public cavalcade, but in the shuttered coach. Small private rooms were built for individual seclusion. The private apartments were located in one area of the house. And the house has radically changed from the suite model, where one room led into another, to the corridor model, where free circulation is possible without barging through other people's bedrooms. Those of you who have gone on tours through Europe and gone into a 17th century or 16th century palace will know, as tourists, you just go round the house, just room after room. There's no corridors. You just go barging through room after room. You ever stop to think what it was like if people were sleeping there? Well, it boggles the mind to think of it. But that's how it used to be. Now, this privacy was the effect of it, is clearly, of not merely of individualism, but also, I would submit, effective individualism. All right. Well, now let us move to the shakiest part of all, which is the ultimate causes of the change that I've been trying to describe. I want to argue, whenever I face a problem like this, I sort of throw the book at it. That is to say, I simply resort to a multi-causal explanation and say, well, there's a whole series of factors at work which are all contributing to this major change in human psyche. Now, people argue with me and say, look, you can't do that. This is just a shopping list. You've got to order them in rank order, which comes first, which comes last. I can't do that. I don't think it's possible to do that. I don't think history works that way. I think history works in a sort of feedback system of everything interlocking with everything else, and all I can do is to say all these things come together to create the situation. That's what I want to do. Right. Now, for the convenience and clarity, I want to group the factors under five heads and argue and say that they all come together. And I'm not ranking them in any rank order. I'm simply listing them just as they come along. We begin with the economic factor, not because I think it's most important, but just simply there it is. The economic factor is best illustrated by a quotation from Dr. Johnson, when he pointed out the corrosive influence of economic growth upon traditional kinship relations and structures. Quote, "You first have large circles or clans, and then as commerce increases, connection is confined to families. But by degrees, that goes off as having become unnecessary, and there being few opportunities of intercourse." Now, what he's saying here, I think, is an interpretation based on economic determinism of how the rise of a market economy causes the disintegration of the kin groups and the rise of possessive individualism, and how possessive individualism in economic factor terms leads to the rise of the isolated nuclear family and so psychological individualism. This is a diagnosis taken up by Engels, of course, a century later. I think it's basically right, but it's terribly incomplete as it stands because it ignores other forces as well, economic forces as well. One of them is the enormous growth and wider distribution of surplus wealth in the 18th century. I mean, this sense of surplus wealth is simply so astonishing to anybody who works in the 18th century, coming from the 17th, which generated a taste for luxury and leisure activities, which in turn stimulated the pursuit of personal gratification. I would argue that modern Western consumerism is the final product of that economic trend. But I think if we stop to think of it, we all know in our own lives it's an economic trend which has important psychological consequences. The supermarket doesn't merely have an economic consequence, it has a psychological consequence by enormously widening the range of individual choice and stimulating the desire to buy. I, as an Englishman, first came to America in 1942. When I first saw an American supermarket, it blew my mind. I mean, I'd just never seen so many sort of goodies sort of spread out before me in my life before. It just sort of changes your whole attitude to physical objects. Now, the social factors, I think, can be very briefly noted. The first is the rise of a wealthy entrepreneurial bourgeoisie and an urban professional elite of lawyers, doctors, and so on, to the two groups which are normally particularly receptive to the ideas of effective individualism, which fits their way of life, based as it is on a strict code of personal conduct, sober, thrifty, self-reliant, monogamous, and so on, in theory anyway. Now, the second social factor which made England so different from continental Europe was the predominance politically, socially, economically, and culturally of a landed squirearchy and the close cultural ties of the squirearchy to the London bourgeoisie. The third factor, the religious factor, cuts both ways. It's much more complicated in its effect, and I want to argue on both sides of the street here. I would argue that both the rise of individualism and the subsequent decline of individualism both play key roles in this story. On the one hand, the Puritans reinforced domestic patriarchy, stressed original sin, and the need to crush the childish will, internalized habits of obedience to the Puritan ethic, and were generally suspicious of sexual pleasure even within the marriage bed. On the other hand, they advocated what they called, quote, holy matrimony, close quote. Holy matrimony, i.e. the need for effective relationships between spouses as blessed by God, as opposed to the Catholic ideal of celibacy. Eventually, this desire for marital affection as being God's will eroded the foundations of their own arguments in favor of the authority of parents to choose mates for their children. Secondly, they encouraged the orientation of the family around the child, since it was, after all, upon the right education of the next generation that the future progress of the saints depended. Now, the first result of such an interest was, as I explained to you, increased repression and indoctrination. Children got beaten up more than they were before because people wanted to mold them into saints. But once you abandon the idea of original sin and abandon the idea of making saints of them, then it opened the way, it seems to me, for a more affectionate and permissive child-parent relationships of the 18th century. Thirdly, the Puritans encouraged, however inadvertently, the rise of individualism by their belief that in the last resort, The godly man is entitled to place his conscience above the dictates of church, state, the law, and society. The belief that occasionally a man must stand up and be counted, even against his state and his society, and if necessary, go to jail or be killed. Now, even more importantly than these legacies of Puritanism were the products of the subsequent massive secularization of all aspects of Western culture, which made possible the Enlightenment. This leads directly to the cultural factor. Dr. Johnson, in some puzzlement, pointed out that in his day there had been a general weakening, not only of patriarchy, but of deference. Quote, "No man has the same authority which his father had, except a jailer." He didn't explain it, he couldn't understand it, he just said, well, the 50 years I've been living, this is what's happened, that people just don't have authority anymore. And he made no attempt to explain how it happened. I would argue that the critical turning point in this evolution was a reversal of attitudes towards the unbridled pursuit of self-interest. From being an evil to be ruthlessly crushed in the public interest, self-interest became to be regarded as an acceptable psychological drive, which was in fact conducive to the public good. And the key words were spoken by Alexander Pope in 1733, as he concluded his examination of the relation of the individual to society with these words, quote, "Thus God and nature linked the general frame and bade self-love and social be the same." I.e., what he's saying is that egotistical self-interest and social good are identical. Well, it's rubbish, of course. It's Reaganomics, but that's what he said. Now, this little couplet of Pope's, it seems to me, displays the full significance of what can only be described as a revolution in human consciousness. The first time men were being told that the egocentric pursuit of self-interest, economic self-interest, or personal self-interest in any shape or form contributed to the public good rather than to its destruction. Finally, I think there was a political factor which helps to explain why England was so far in advance of continental Europe. There is, I think, some evidence to suggest there's nearly always been a direct psychological link between the more traditional kinds of right-wing authoritarian governments and support for patriarchy in the family as the last defense of the threatened male. The correlation, I would argue, holds good for the 20th century. Look at Pétain in France, Salazar in Portugal, or Franco in Spain. All three traditional authoritarian rulers, all of them zealous defenders of the patriarchal family. Now, I think these convergent forces I've tried to describe to you can adequately give a sort of fixus and explain the abandonment of the principle of human interchangeability, the rise of the concept that each person is unique and cannot be replicated, and the rise of the concept of individual autonomy, the freedom to pursue each person to pursue his selfish goals. The growth of affect or sentiment, however, requires further analysis, and I would suggest it has to be caused by some basic personality change. Now, this is highly controversial, I warn you. This is explosive stuff, and a lot of people think it's nonsense. In the 16th and 17th century, I at any rate believe there predominated a personality type whose capacity for warm relationships was generally limited. I believe that if any of you in this room were suddenly transported back to the 16th or early 17th century, if you were transported back to Boston in 1660, say, you would go into a psychic shock within about 3 weeks. Simply because people were so beastly to one another. You'd be traumatized by the harshness and manipulativeness of the society. The second point is that people in the 16th and 17th century diffused what little affection they did have very widely. Instead of being concentrated, it was spread very widely amongst family, kin, friends, neighbors, and so on. Now, in the upper bourgeoisie and squirek of the 18th century, I find, at any rate, a different personality type. I find it in correspondence, I find it in literature, I find it wherever I look. Persons whose capacity for intimate personal relations was much greater than it was in the 17th century, and whose ties were now much more closely focused on spouse and children. It's narrowly down, relatives and neighbors sort of fall apart, fall away, and it's now closely focused on spouse and children. Now, it seems to me at least plausible to associate this personality change, if I'm correct that there was indeed a personality change, which not everybody will agree with, to the changes we have already noted in child-rearing, the abandonment of swaddling, maternal breastfeeding and fondling, and a more permissive education based on affection and encouragement. Now, of course, you must realize this is a circular argument, and my argument is indeed circular, that the whole thing is turning back upon itself and feeding on itself. Now, if these facts are correct, if the change in the new family type took place in the early 17th to mid-17th century, if the lead was taken by the upper and professional classes in squirearchy, followed soon after by many members of the aristocracy, if the trend was arrested and even reversed for about 80 years in the 19th century Victorian period, then it seems to me certain major common hypotheses about the evolution of modern Western civilization can't be true. Let's take first the theory of modernization. The idea that some coherent package of forces creating an irresistible and progressive trend towards a uniform socio-economic system, the modern or postmodern world, namely America today. The idea that one day the whole world will look like northern New Jersey and have family relationships which are applicable to northern New Jersey. Well, I don't think that's true. If my facts are correct, it won't work. It can't be true. The timing is pre-industrial. The development is erratic and irregular. The social matrix is highly specific to the middle and upper classes. And religion and culture affect changes in the family enormously. And it seems to me you've put all this together and it won't work. So I think any sociological theory based on overarching concept of modernization marching logically and relentlessly and uniformly through the recent centuries about to take over the whole world is less than convincing. In fact, it's nonsense. It won't happen. Another explanation of the evolution of present-day society is that it is a product of industrial capitalism. The family, the modern family, is a product of modern capitalism, industrial capitalism. Engels argued that, and been argued with Marxists and non-Marxists ever since. Engels first said that the free contract system of labor relations, which is on which industrial society is based, presupposes a free contract system of marital relations. Why, he never made very clear, but that's what he said. Now, the thing is full of historical errors, it seems to me, but what's bizarre about the whole story is it's now become the accepted dogma of Parsonian functional sociology. And the major objection to this, both to the Marxist and to the Parsonians, is that the class analogy I put before you, the chronology I put before you, just doesn't fit this model. It's the bourgeoisie and the gentry and the aristocracy, not the working class, who first formulated the new ideals, and they did so long before the Industrial Revolution. I think a better explanation towards the trend of the new family type is the cultural one. First formulated, as far as I know, by Alexis de Tocqueville, when in 1835 he came to America and surveyed the American scene. To Tocqueville, in 1835, the key to the change which he observed, as a Frenchman he was amazed by what he saw in America, as you know, it was what he called, quote, the democratic spirit, and what I'm now calling the spirit of individualism. He said that, compared with the past, quote, in our time, this is 1835, the members of the family stand upon an entirely different footing towards each other. Distance which separated the father from his son has been lessened, and paternal authority, if not destroyed, is at least impaired. And Tocqueville went on to note striking changes in the emotional character of private correspondence, changes in the legal rights of husbands and wives, early emancipation of young people from parental control, all the things I've been talking about for the last hour. And he found them particularly noticeable in the two Anglo-Saxon societies of England and America, for exactly the reasons I've been putting forward. And he says that the major cultural shift was fostered by Protestantism and reinforced by the rights of self-government. Quote, freedom is then infused into the domestic circles by political habits and religious opinions, i.e. self-government and Protestantism are the two keys that Tocqueville saw as the moat engines of this great change. Now, what he clearly leaves out is the huge importance of economic and social factors, which we've been talking about. Now, let's end on a note of caution. There's no reason to assume that the family type which emerged was necessarily, in all respects, more conducive to either personal happiness or the public good, and in, particularly the public good, than the family types which preceded it. Affective individualism, after all, is a theory which lacks any firm foundation in biological, anthropological, or sociological data. As Philip Slater has pointed out, quote, "The notion that people begin as separate individuals, who then march out and connect themselves with others, is one of the most dazzling pieces of self-mystification in the history of the species." Well, it's overstating it a bit, but it's not far wrong. The ideal has obviously produced several unfortunate results, as well as many good ones. For one thing, power is a zero-sum game. What somebody gains, somebody loses. Increased autonomy and of ties with a kin has deprived the wife of much external help previously available in adjusting to life under a husband and of child-rearing and child-care. It's a decline of respect. I don't think it's too reactionary to suggest that the decline of respect for lineage and ancestry in the concept of oneself as a trustee for handling blood, property, and tradition has resulted in some loss of personal identity. Finally, the highly permissive child-rearing practiced in many middle and upper-class households of the 18th century and again today has bred large numbers of ill-disciplined and poorly socialized children who have grown up to be adults with demands for instant gratification which cannot be satisfied by society. Now, the distribution of affective ties, like that of power, is also something of a zero-sum game. Although, as I have explained, love, unlike power, can change in quantity over time. But I would argue that the highly personalized, inward-looking modern family was achieved in part at the cost of, and perhaps in part because of, a withdrawal from the rich and integrated community life of the past, with its common rituals, festivals, fairs, feast days, and a tradition of charity and mutual aid. Aye, what I'm arguing is privacy and community can't both be expanded together. They're antithetical needs, and if the one goes up, the other goes down, like balances. Now, I don't think there's much doubt that England and America were at least half a century ahead of the rest of Western Europe in developing a set of family relationships dominated by this ideal or myth of effective individualism. But like democracy itself, I don't think there's much reason to be too confident that this ideal or myth has any very assured future before it. It fitted a certain society with certain values at certain times. It is something which has transformed the lives of all who have been influenced by it, and has left a deeper imprint upon the literature and arts of a 200-year span. Now, it is one of the paradoxes of history that in the last decade, the last 10 years, this ideal of effective individualism has been pushed to such extreme lengths that it has been undermining and destroying the very institution which first embodied it, namely the modern family. The single-minded search by men, women, and children for self-gratification, self-fulfillment, and personal pleasure, regardless of the cost to others, is rapidly undermining, this is a fact, I'm not really putting forward value judgments, I'm just stating a fact, is clearly undermining the affection-bonded, companionate, child-oriented nuclear family, which the ideal first created as an institutional norm in the 18th century. As a result, the postmodern family, which is what we have today, is beginning to look very different from the model which preceded it and from which it evolved. Now, the characteristics of the postmodern family are as follows. Thanks to efficient contraceptive techniques, sexual relations have become almost entirely separated from the biological function of procreation and the legal institution of marriage. The pill and penicillin have removed the risks of pregnancy and venereal disease, which in previous periods inhibited sexual relations outside marriage. Now such relations can be easily entered into and as casually broken off, with no cost to either party. Despite the high psychic and economic cost of divorce, marriage itself is now only a temporary arrangement to be terminated if one or other partner finds it inconvenient. If present trends persist, one half of all current American marriages will end in divorce. So we're now moving into an era of serial polygamy. It has to be admitted, of course, that serial polygamy was common in the pre-modern period when death caused frequent remarriages. It was serial polygamy was caused previously by death, now it's been caused by divorce. The traditional division of responsibilities between husband and wife is collapsing now that over half of all married women have full-time jobs outside the home.
The feminist movement has eroded virtually all the privileges and authority which previously remained to her husband in the companionate marriage. Moreover, the strong child orientation that characterized the previous generation to produce the baby boom of the 1950s has quite suddenly diminished. A recent poll showed that 9% of all young, well-educated New York women plan to have no children at all, either because they might interfere with their careers or because of the high cost in time and money. Now, they may change their minds later on, we don't know, but that's what they say to the pollster. Those who do have children delay birth until the last possible moment and limit the number to one or perhaps two. They then go back to work, leaving the infant to be cared for by a nurse or daycare center. When divorce seems desirable, little attention is paid to the interests or wishes of the child. Only 7% of all American families today conform to the former stereotype of mother, father, and two children. 7%. 18% of all children are illegitimate, i.e. are born to couples who are not married. This, of what I know, is for the Western world a world record. The West certainly has never had an illegitimacy rate of 18% before, ever. Now, I'm not saying whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, I'm just saying we're moving into a different era. It's far too soon, I think, to pass judgment on the postmodern family and decide whether or not the pursuit of individual happiness has been pushed to the point of self-defeat. What can be said, I think, is that the emerging features of the postmodern family are strikingly different from those of the modern family, although both were and are driven forward by the same ideal, the ideal of effective individualism. But this merely reinforces my conclusion. The rise of this ideal in the 18th century England and America began one of the most important psychological, moral, and cultural changes in the history of the West. Its effects are still in the process of being worked out today. Thank you very much.
Agreed to answer questions, so I'll ask you to raise your hand. I'll recognize you, and I'll ask our speaker to repeat the question so that you will hear the question he's answering. Question?
Question on the what do you think might happen now? I noticed the thing in the paper tonight. Youth are going to organize. What do you think of the changes coming with this depression we're in now?
One of the minor virtues of historians is that we are not prophets.
Any other person have the courage to ask a question?
The changes in the rite of passage of children in 17th, 18th, 19th century, and the imposition of the concept of being a teenager, where does that begin?
The question is the problem of when does the teenage problem begin? When does adolescence, in fact, become a historical problem, right? No, it's not. At least I don't think so. I mean, you can have the whole series of ideas about this. You have G. Stanley Hall, who tells you it's about 1890. You have John Gillis, who tells you it's 1820. I will tell you I can find perfectly agonized debates and arguments about what they called youth, which meant the period between sexual maturity and when you get a job and you marry. This is the point of time. You are sexually mature, but you're not married, and you haven't a steady job. You are an apprentice working under somebody, and you're in a bachelor situation. That, by my definition, is youth or teenager, or whatever you like to call it. That has been with us from at least the 16th century, when males anyway, became sexually mature rather later than today, probably around 16. They did not, on the other hand, marry until they were 25. There's about a 10-year gap, and this was a real problem. And there were huge riots in London. Whenever a revolution broke out, these kids poured out in the streets and joined in, of course, naturally, and were causing all hell of a problem. And a lot of complaints about how dangerous they were. And in New England, of course, teenagers and indeed adolescents, as they were called, unmarried young males were not allowed to live alone. They had to live in a family, so there was somebody to keep an eye on them to prevent them getting into trouble. So it's a problem. It has been with us at least since the 16th century, and I would guess a lot longer. And the theory that was suddenly invented in our time, I think, is rubbish.
You divorced your topic from the economic factors, but wouldn't it be true that if the man and the family were easily able to earn enough for his wife and his children, we would revert a little more to the paternalistic pattern?
You might. This is absolutely true. I think the problem is, in our modern consumer society, if you get used to two incomes and you're earning sort of $50,000 or something, because you're two people earning $25,000, it's very hard to go back to 25. I think people get used to the income that they're earning. And this is a built-in situation. And once you've lived for 10 years with two incomes, to drop back to one income, which means a shrinkage of consumer patterns, is, I think, in our society, which is so consumer-oriented, a very difficult thing to happen. It may happen, but I can't see it happening yet. Can you? You think it can happen? Well, maybe. We'll see.
You mentioned the rise of the disapproval of cruelty as an unusual aspect at the beginning of this period. What do you feel was the impetus for this change in attitude?
I haven't the faintest idea. The trouble with history, as you may perhaps, or maybe don't know if you do it, is that the really important questions we don't know the answers to. And you know, I'm serious about this. I mean, that's one of them. It's a very good question. We really don't know. As I said to you, the first example I can find in a legal statute which says you really shouldn't torture people or beat them up and so on, or to animals or women and things, is the laws of Massachusetts of 1648. I can't find it before. I don't know. All I can say to you is it does seem to me a highly Anglo-Saxon, I don't want to be sort of racialist about this, it's simply America, North America, and Northwestern Europe does seem to me the area where it developed first and most strongly. And even when I was young, you went south through Europe, so southern France, and then northern Italy, southern Italy, people started being crueler to the animals in sort of quite obvious ways. And it looked as if it was a sort of north-south phenomenon. Then you went across to Ireland and the same thing was happening. So I don't know. I really don't know. I honestly do not know the explanation. It's clearly a culturally determined phenomenon, and the causes of which are, I think, I don't think any historian in the world could tell you the answer to this. It's a very good question.
Professor Stahl, could you say a few words about the Victorian era? Was it the reaction from the previous century? And are we now having a reaction to the Victorian era?
I think the answer to the second question is almost certainly yes. We are. The question was of the Victorian period, which I stated, thank God, I didn't have to deal with. And somebody always asked me this question, having explicitly stated I wasn't going to answer it, and I'm tempted into doing so. So I'm now tempted, and here we are. I think the reaction today is undoubtedly to the rather repressive sexual and patriarchal features of Victorian family. I think there's no doubt about that. And you can see these great swings going on, and they'll swing back. And I think the moral majority is the first sign of a counter development occurring as a swing, the pendulum begins to swing back again. Why? The question is really, is why did this growth of this particular family type go into reverse gear in certain aspects, in terms of patriarchy, in terms of sexuality? In certain aspects of sexuality, but I should emphasize that there were probably more prostitutes in the big cities of Europe and America in the 19th century than any other time in world history, as far as we know, per capita. It's staggering. But in theoretical terms, anyway. Why this happened, we don't really know. There's two hypotheses. One is that the upper classes decided that the threat of the French Revolution scared them silly, and that somehow the lower classes had to be disciplined. And discipline meant social discipline, moral discipline, religious discipline, drive them back into the churches, etc., 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 and drive themselves back into the churches, too. A second is, and some evidence for that, the second, and Methodism works pretty well for that, the second argument is a religious revival, which is particularly associated with Methodism, and then with the evangelical religion. And this has the normal run of great religious revivals of about 50 years or so. This is what religious revivals have, and then it begins to peter out. And this one petered out roughly on schedule, as one would expect, I think. But I'm no Victorian historian. I started in the 16th century, I moved to the 17th, and now in the 18th, and now people are forcing me to answer questions in the 19th, about which I know very little. So this is a highly speculative. The question is, given the evidence of the adaptability of the human animal to adopt to different circumstances, how do I predict that the child is going to react to serial polygamy? As I said before, I'm not a prophet. I'm an historian. I really don't know. The evidence with all I can say is that what I've read of evidence of dealing with primates, and that is dealing with chimpanzees and orangutans, depriving them of their mothers, etc., suggests that the effects are not very good. If you deprive a child of a very young chimpanzee of his mother at an early point in his career, he has a hard time adjusting. On the other hand, more recent results apparently have suggested that human children who are put in orphanages and given a very rough time in an orphanage and then are adopted by an affectionate family adjust very well and do respond. And the whole Freudian idea that your whole psyche is traumatized at the age of 3 and nothing you can do about it appears not to be true. That, I think, is now emerging. It seems to be fairly clear from the literature. So I don't know. I think it's... what do you think? Well, you probably know more about it than I do. I bet you do, too.
What was the role of Cromwell in the onset of this phenomenon you've been talking about?
None. the Puritans in his time, the late 1640s, made adultery punishable by death. We have the case of one woman the jury once convicted and may once have been hung. We have only one example which we're fairly sure the woman actually got, men of course didn't got away with it, got hung on this act, but I don't think this affected life very much one way or the other.
I think two more questions.
You say in 1835 Tocqueville came over to America and seemed to observe that political habits and religious convictions in bring very much to us seem to be cultural images behind whatever we saw. Do these ideas arise and apply anywhere?
How do you mean? Tocqueville was a bestseller. Widely translated, a great bestseller. Everybody read him, and Americans, presumably, I don't know. I'm not a 19th century American historian. I assume they said, yes, this is how we are, and this is how we became what we are.
He widely
read in England, widely read in France. The French paid no attention to this, in the sense that the French family life, I think, evolved in its own way. The English read him quite a lot. How much attention they paid to it, I really, if you ask me what the historical effect of Tocqueville's democracy in America was, this is the question you're asking me, isn't it, basically?
No. It would seem that John Locke's ideas
That had an actual effect, yes. It's like Dr. Spock. You publish this book, you read it and say, okay, we're going to treat my child like X. Yes.
Did something like that happen?
I don't, well, I, you know, you push me into the 19th century, and I'm not really an expert, and you push me into America, and I'm a European historian. I don't, my impression talking to American historians is the answer is no. It did not have the effect of a Dr. Spock or a John Locke, of really molding the behavior patterns of parents and towards children over. No, it doesn't appear to have done. I don't think.
Further questions?
18% figure of real agency at the present time has probably been the largest in the history of the West. I wonder, if you took the aristocracy around 1660, 100% there, it wouldn't be much higher. And then if you looked at the agricultural population, America would be a small number. But if you looked at the agricultural population, the kinds of marriages, the kinds of sexual behavior that you know took place there, wouldn't be with those two groups, you know, I'm taking it to the opposite extreme now.
The aristocracy, you might, if we'd ever get the figures, very hard to know. The lower classes, what you have in the late 17th, 18th century, a lot, as you must know, of these very dubious marriages. They were consensual marriages. They appeared to be legal. I wasn't sure they were legal. Were who producing children? We are, you know, at the mercy of our data. And our data, which is when a clergyman actually turns to write down in the parish register, illegitimate or bastard or worse to this effect, or simply give two different names to the father and the mother. And that has been done, and the highest we get is something like 8% in the 18th century, in the late 18th century. We don't get anything higher than that. So it's nothing like 18. Now, the reality may be more than that. It may be that clergymen were not, and this is only the villages where we're fairly certain he was writing it down. Maybe he was missing 50%. I don't think so. The evidence does suggest that this was a fairly highly sexually disciplined society in the 17th century when the figures are down to 4%. You're marrying a 26, and you have a 4% illegitimacy rate with no contraceptive devices. This is a staggering situation, really, you know. It's extraordinary. But that's what we appear to have. And it rises dramatically to, quite dramatically, about 8% in the 18th century and about 9 or even 10 by in the 19th. But that's about all that any figure I've ever seen of England or France or Germany. Now, maybe the data is incomplete. But I should be said, by the way, the 18% is slightly skewed. The black population is up to 40%. The white population is down to, I don't know what, 10 or something. So it's a skewed figure. But still, it's still a remarkable figure, I think.
Well, Professor Robert Kubicek, the head of the History Department, will thank our speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should like, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to point out that it's our good fortune at UBC to have Professor Stone with us for a better part of the week. As our Cecil and I have been with the professor, but on his talks with us this week, one on Tuesday noon, money, sex, and murder in 18th century England. Professor Stone, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the audience for your description of the 18th century high bourgeois society of England, your witty and evocative description of their lifestyle, and your explanation of the motives behind that lifestyle, and taking us through what you described as a treacherous bog of historical explanation that included some, at least tipping of the hat to a neo-Marxist or Marxist explanation, to rehabilitating a bit the Puritan ethic, and particularly the insights of the 18th century and provide some context for applying them in the present. You said you weren't a prophet, but I suspect you made a lot of us think more coherently about what's before us as far as families in North America are concerned. Thank you very much.